morning, everybody. Matt Bubala with you, 720 WGN. Hello, Roger Badish.
Matt Bubala, congratulations.
Hey, thanks, buddy. For everybody
so
not in the know.
Excited.
We talked about this a little bit last week. I was managing our Tri-Cities Little League 10U All-Star team. No, 11U this year All-Star team. They're a year older. 11U All-Stars. And they won the state championship.
That's awesome. God, that's fantastic.
It was really cool. So happy for those boys who really worked their butts off and gave up pretty much their whole summer. So that ended last Saturday.
Mm-hmm.
And now the public schools in our town start school on Tuesday.
Already? Wow.
Yeah. So they got 7 days of summer.
Oy.
Because they pretty much more or less had to give it up otherwise.
Yeah.
I also need to say congratulations to our 10-year-old All-Star team. I did say this last week because they had already won the state championship on Thursday night. So for the first time in our 64-year Little League history in our town, two teams won the state tournament.
That's fantastic.
It was really cool. Really fun. Really nice.
They must have been so excited.
They were very excited. Our town had a little procession for both teams down Route 31 and 72 over to our fields, led by fire trucks and police cars. It was really cool.
Very nice.
It was fun. So now we're trying to soak up a little bit of summer before the kids all go back to school.
Oh, geez. You know what? Do what a bunch of my students used to do over the years. They showed up when they felt like it.
Raj, here's the thing. In the Bubala house, we're sending the kids to Catholic school, which means we're writing a check, which means we're paying for it, which means you're going to school.
Well, public schools are paying for it, too, in taxes, but still.
I'm paying for those, too.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, you are. But we would get notes. The kid would come back like 2 weeks late and says, oh, sorry, our family was on vacation. I'm like, so?
You know, when
the note doesn't excuse you.
When Colleen used to teach in Des Plaines, there were a lot of kids of migrant farmers. And so they would come and go for months at a time.
Yeah.
And they'd go back home to Mexico, then they'd come back.
That makes sense.
Sometimes that's how life works. However, the kids are going back to school. Although Tommy's been trying to work out a deal with me this week.
What?
My son Tommy is very big into, as I've talked about before, landscaping, mowing the lawn, cutting the grass, trimming things, shoveling snow, all this stuff. He really... Yeah. He keeps bugging me this week. I have to work on this tomorrow. He's got a little flyer he wants to pass out in the neighborhood.
Okay.
He's mowed a few different neighbors' lawns this year when they went on vacation, but he really wants to kick this into high gear. And so he said, well, I want to make a deal with you. And I said, okay. He said, if I get all A's and B's, and I said, okay, then when we have a huge snow, if I have some clients in the neighborhood, I get to stay home from school and do those driveways.
Ooh.
And I said, all right, let me think about this. So you've got all A's and B's going, because Tommy's struggles. He's unfortunately for Tommy, a little bit too much like his father. School's not the favorite thing in the world. So he gets B's and C's, I mean, and the occasional A. But he said, if I get all A's and B's, I could stay home and shovel and plow the driveways.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, okay, you can't have the whole day. But maybe till like lunch or 10 a.m. I think I told him 10 a.m. You get to go in late, go in like at 10. So from 7 to 10, you can go get all the driveways done.
Yeah.
So he likes that deal.
All right.
And my parents never did motivation with me on things like that.
Yeah, mine didn't either.
I was a third child and I was kind of a accident. So I think they just sort of like,
join the club.
Let's see how it turns out. Let's just let them roll.
Yeah.
They did not like put a lot of effort into making sure the homework was getting done, the grades were good, things like that.
I could slack off. I don't know how it was with you, but I would slack off, but I would pay the price later.
Yeah.
Like when the grades would come in or the phone call would come in or something like that.
There were a lot of sheepish days coming home with a note that had to be signed. Or when I would come to the car and be like, Mom, Mr. Nordyke says you have to come inside before you go home. Man, was she mad that day.
Yeah, I didn't make sixth grade graduation.
How do you graduate from
sixth grade? Well, I mean, I did eventually, but there was a parent meeting.
Those parent meetings were the worst days of my life,
that
man.
Roger had to do this or there was no graduation.
We had parent-teacher conferences every semester, and that was like the worst day, 2 days of my year, every year. Sweating that out, having to go in and have the teachers tell my mom what's really going on. Ugh. Ugh. It was the worst. So I made this deal with Tommy. So we'll see. He's determined to buy a second snowblower. We have a snowblower. He wants a second one.
He wants a pull them both?
He says, well, then you'll come out and do it with me. I'm like, Tommy, I already have multiple jobs. I got three of them. I am not adding this to my resume.
Oh,
no.
Man.
He's like, well, then I'll make Michael do it. I said, well, that's fine. But Michael could just shovel while you're plowing.
Right.
He's 12. Yeah. So we had a great week. We won the state tournament. Baseball's finally over, so we get a little bit of downtime before we get back to school, although cross country started this week. So I went out to cross country practice with the kids on Friday morning, and they ran, which is good for us all. So I'm not going to complain about that. So life is good. I cannot complain, especially since it all could be over at any moment, Raj.
Really? I wonder when we were going to get to that.
Well, I mean, I don't mean to make light of it at all, because it's, you know, it's never good when we're making threats about what I would say is nuclear war, because when you say fire and fury like the world has never seen, well, the world has seen some serious fire and fury.
That's right.
We just had the anniversaries this week, right, of what, Nagasaki and Hiroshima?
Mm-hmm.
They're both just a day apart, weren't they, or 2 days apart? So we've seen some fire and fury, a lot of it, and it was very interesting to have those anniversaries this week when that rhetoric was being thrown about, because if you read the stories, 70,000 dead on impact, I believe, in Hiroshima, or in, it was Nagasaki, was just the other day, right? The second one. And it's terrible, terrible that I am somebody who grew up in a time where I don't know enough about this.
But it doesn't really matter, because both of them happened so close together. And I've read stories of what scenes looked like. I mean, we've seen pictures.
Pictures were
out
this
week. But I actually read the stories of survivors who walked around and saw there were shadows of people.
Can't imagine.
On the sides of buildings that were still, walls still standing. This was the most disgusting thing that you could even think of.
So we have seen this before. The world has. And maybe we're not aware enough about it. Maybe too much time has passed by and we don't pay enough attention. And that's when history tends to repeat itself.
Yeah.
But so we, you know, have had a lot of bluster about this over the past week.
Were you alive during the Cuban Missile Crisis?
No, I wasn't born. Well, no, that was 63, wasn't it?
Yeah.
No, yeah, I was born in 71.
The tension in this country, you couldn't cut it with a knife because it was so thick and heavy. People, you think people were worried about bomb shelters then. This is crazy what is happening now. Cuba is like a really strong arm stone's throw from Florida and from everywhere else in the country. And there were Russian missiles with nuclear warheads heading towards Cuba. They had launch sites set and everything.
Not just heading there, they were already there.
Well,
more were coming.
So the scare factor here in America, people who were alive then are hearing this now, and they're saying it can't happen again. It's crazy. I can't even verbalize it, because it's frustrating that in 2017 we have not learned from Hiroshima and Nagasaki. We have not learned from Vietnam War. We have not learned from the Cuban Missile Crisis. We have not learned, and we're making the same mistakes. And a lot of people could say, well, it's not us, it's them. It takes two to tango.
It does, it does. There's no doubt. But they're the ones trying to get the nuclear weapons. Although we do have somebody in office right now who's not afraid to talk the talk about it. That's for sure. We have not had a president threatening to use nuclear weapons. And he hasn't said the term nuclear, but when you say fire and fury like the world has never seen, you're talking nuclear. We have not had presidents threaten that ever, that I know of, in my lifetime. And so here we are talking about it like it's a possibility. And with a rogue state that is, and I will say this in defense of Donald Trump. Brace yourselves. North Korea is going to keep going. That's the danger here, and that's where I do believe that any of these countries who are being sanctioned to death because of their nuclear programs, they just keep going, because eventually, if they get the bomb, everybody has to come back to the table.
Yeah.
And so in some way, while Kim Jong-un is clearly a lunatic, and that's a lunatic regime, And you hear the stories of the terrible things they do to people. But if they get nuclear bombs, if they have the ability to attack other countries, that makes everybody stop and say, okay, now we have to deal with them, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it kind of does.
Yeah.
Because nobody wants them to drop a bomb and then have to bomb them. So then we start negotiating. And the terms get better for them if they get it. So there's no real reason for them not to, especially if some people help enable them.
Yeah.
While these sanctions are tougher than ever that they passed last week, and it's going to cut their GDP by a third, right? I mean, it's really going to hurt them
mm-hmm.
financially. But the one thing that scares me about all this, because I think most of it's a bunch of bluster, right? But then yesterday on Friday, I was reading a story that in a Chinese newspaper, an editorial, and I don't know enough about it, but I would say in China, it's different than the U.S. If the Tribune editorializes about what the U.S. would do, that's the Tribune's opinion or whoever mm-hmm. wrote it. In China, where the media is a little more government controlled, I would assume, and that's how this was written, that this piece was speaking on behalf of the government. They said that if North Korea attacks the U.S., China will stay out of it, whatever the U.S. does.
Yeah.
But if the U.S. preemptively attacks Korea, China will be on the side of Korea.
Yeah.
Well, that's not good.
Nope.
Now, maybe that is what we put forward to the public, and maybe there are back channels being worked by Washington that they'd have a sort of agreement on what happens here, because hopefully China also doesn't want them to acquire nuclear weapons and wants to figure out a way to stop them before this gets too serious. But it sounds like, you know, the story came out this week that it is believed that North Korea has figured out a way to miniaturize their nuclear weapons to fit them on a warhead
mm-hmm.
and or on a missile and send them to other countries. That's really bad news, right? Especially yeah. since they tested a missile a week or so ago that they now believe could reach the U.S. mainland. And I believe we read as far as Chicago, right?
I believe so, yeah.
Now, I don't think we'd be number one on the list, but the idea that missiles could get here from Korea, North Korea, is not good news by any means.
No.
And you just hope to God that this administration knows what they're doing, that, you know, that it's crazy like a fox, not just crazy.
I'm concerned, going with what you were saying, that the possibility that countries who are under sanctions right now are still going on developing nuclear weapons, and that eventually they will get them. My fear is, and I think it's a legitimate fear, is that so many countries will have a nuclear weapon that one of them eventually is just going to press the button.
Either that or a country gets thrown over and this stuff ends up in the wrong hands, right?
Isn't that true?
Now, some people would say, well, that's what's happened in the U.S.
Well, but let's keep opinion out of it.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? Because we have not. And we have, this country has tried to negotiate with other countries agreements on not using nuclear weapons. And that has held pretty well so far.
Yeah, it just takes one, though.
Yeah, I know it does.
Right?
I know. That's what I'm saying.
The precarious thing about this yeah. for all time, as long as a bunch of people have them, the danger is somebody someday yeah. decides, well, let's use one.
Yeah.
And let's face it, Donald Trump came into office asking about that. Like, how come we never use these things? And what's the good of having them if you're not going to use them ever? And maybe he's just ratcheting that up to fine, we're not going to use them, but I'm going to threaten like hell that we're going to use them because I'm tired of this. And you can't blame him. For whatever President Obama and President Bush and President Clinton and President Bush and President Reagan, whoever, mm-hmm. over the decades have done with North Korea, there they are miniaturizing nuclear weapons to be able to send to the U.S. mainland.
Yeah.
So sanctions not working so good, right? I mean, it's all not working so well. So you can't blame in some ways a president for saying, we're not putting up with this anymore. And if you want to keep acting like this, there's going to be consequences. Now, he didn't put it that eloquently, unfortunately.
Right.
Or maybe fortunately. We don't know. But Korea is not going to back down publicly, that's for sure.
Mm-hmm.
We heard also this week that there are back channels that have been negotiating and working with them all along. We'll see where all of that ends up. Okay. Let's take a break from the real world and nuclear fallout. After the news, Rafe Bartholomew is going to join us. 2 and 2, McSorley's My Dad and Me. Story about the oldest bar in New York and his growing up with his dad working there and him eventually working there. Stories of fathers and sons coming up after the news, which is next, 720 WGN. Good morning, everybody. Matt Bubala with you here, 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate Showcase Studio here in the Tribune Tower on the Magnificent Mile. Joining us on the phone, I believe from New York City, is Rafe Bartholomew. He's the author of 2 and 2, McSorley's My Dad and Me. Hey, Rafe, how are you this morning?
Doing all right, Matt. How's it going?
Good. Thanks for jumping on the phone with us. Are you in New York City or where are you located?
I'm actually in on the other side of the country in Los Angeles at the moment. I'm sort of back and forth between here and home in New York. I moved out here for work a little while ago and, you know, just been back and forth ever since.
Sure. Well, it makes a lot more sense you being out with us at 2:40 in the morning if you're in New York than if you're in L.A. than in New York right now. So thanks for jumping on the phone with us. We do appreciate it. The book 2 and 2 came out earlier this year in May. And I found it, Rafe, because somebody had, I think, tweeted a little piece of it that was printed about Enema Man. And I had never heard of McSorley's. The oldest bar, is it the oldest bar then in the country or just in New York City?
Definitely not in the country, but in New York we have a piece of that title. I think the official, you know, the stickler's definition here is that McSorley's is the oldest continuously operating bar in New York City, which means, you know, it's been open and in the same place since 1854. There's a couple other places in New York that are in older buildings or may have been open first but didn't serve alcohol until some later date. So that have sort of a slice of the oldest bar title. But so McSorley's is the one that has been there on East 7th Street in the East Village running as a bar since 1854.
163 years. That is absolutely insane. What did they do during Prohibition?
So McSorley's is lucky in that it has a pretty strong, like, historical case for being open during Prohibition. For starters, New York was just a wet town. You know, the governor at the time, Al Smith, did not believe in Prohibition at all. He was Irish American, Roman Catholic, kind of just wasn't buying into the national program, and didn't devote a lot of state resources to enforcing it. So a lot of bars in New York were able to sort of stay open on the low. Probably people were on the take at the time, but it was not that much of a stretch. There are a couple historical documents. There's a famous John Sloan painting, actually several John Sloan paintings from the period that show McSorley's open and running during Prohibition. There's an E.E. Cummings poem that he wrote during Prohibition inside the bar where everyone's drinking. So basically, they closed up the front and led people in through an apartment entrance on the side, and everything was basically the same. They had to buy some of the ale from new sources. But besides that, things ran as usual at McSorley's.
That's so crazy to think about. Is the name always been McSorley's ever since 1854?
No, so John McSorley, who first opened the bar, named it the Old House at Home, and it remained that during his, during his lifetime, when he passed away in the early 1900s, his son Bill, when he officially took it over, named it McSorley's Old Ale House because it had been around that long by that point, already around 50 years, and, in tribute to his dad.
Man, that's crazy. How many ownerships has it gone through? Is it still related to the original family at all?
It's not related to the original family, but it has not turned over many times. It's only been in three different families over, the wow. Entire 163-year history. The current owner, Matthew Marr, has owned the place since 1977. He actually tended bar with my father before, before he went down to buy the place and become the boss.
That's crazy. So he's owned it for 40 years.
Yeah, and he's sure to pass it along to you know, his daughters and their husbands, who all many of whom, you know, work and help run the place now, and have been involved really my entire lifetime. I think you know, his sons-in-law were sort of, you know, in early 20s when I was a kid, and I looked up to them like older brothers being around the bar.
Now, is your dad still tending bar there?
My father fills in, so he's sort of off active duty, but because they know he's not too far away, and can sort of he still has it. He still gets called in to work, you know, regularly enough, but he's not in the full time rotation.
He's semi-retired.
Semi-retired after 45 years.
45 years.
You know, we would say that he's earned it. Yeah.
Yeah. No kidding. So this book is kind of the story of you growing up in and around the bar, of your dad bartending there since 1972, and your stories of the bar itself. What made you decide to write? Was it just you had so many great stories, or is it really about you and your father and how you guys grew with each other through the bar?
It's both. I mean, it's you know, I think the decision to write about it, the desire to write about it, comes from, you know, growing up in the bar, learning to work there eventually myself. I mean, I spent, you know, about 5 years, you know, also sort of helping, filling in behind the bar. And so it's like the stories and the history of the place that you absorb and sort of gets both through osmosis and through the repetition of telling the history to customers and hearing everyone sort of express all the stories of the bar. It's sort of the desire to write comes from that oral tradition of storytelling and sort of witty stuff, and also like wanting to sort of honor my dad's career. I always, you know, looked up to him like he was doing something, one of the coolest things in the world. So I was very lucky in that. You know, I think a lot of people, you know, hope to be able to say that about their parents, their moms and dads. I was lucky enough to get to write a book sort of about it.
Yeah. It's mentioned a lot that a lot of famous writers, you mentioned a couple, would visit McSorley's. Did McSorley's in some way inspire you to become a writer?
I think absolutely, because like I was mentioning before, even though, you know, that not everyone there is actively engaged in creative writing pursuits, it's just the kind of place where the stories and the exaggeration and sort of making and being able to entertain are just the lifeblood of most bars, or a lot of bars, and certainly McSorley's, where, you know, I mean, that's what, whether it's people when it's talking to customers and telling the stories of the history of the bar, whether it's sort of the banter that goes on back and forth between the staff, all of that, you know, there's such a premium and such respect for, you know, being able to tell a story well, being funny, being clever, you know, a lot of little things that become part of writing. I was learning and hearing just by listening to the guys at the bar as a kid.
Well, I would imagine a bar like that is there's no greater place to observe the human condition and just learn about people, because, you know, I imagine you have regulars, you have tourists, you have people coming and going, and you just get to see a little kaleidoscope of all sorts of aspects of human life every night.
Yeah, I mean, a busy bar in New York or any great city is sort of, you see just such a, I mean, and you certainly get to observe, you know, a heavy or strong enough dose of sort of the dark side of people and some of the things, you know, some of the demons we all have, yeah. Which, as you mentioned, you know, it's part of the human condition. But yeah, I mean, and I think that's something you people who've, you know, worked in and for any length of time in bars or restaurants, different service jobs, that ability to observe and to some extent read people in terms of, you know, how to interact with them during those short times when folks are coming in as customers, and you sort of want to size them up and figure out what are they about and what's going to be the best way to serve them.
We're speaking with Rafe Bartholomew. The book is 2 and 2, McSorley's My Dad and Me. Came out in hardback in May. When we come back, I want to have Rafe tell the story of Enema Man, because that's what turned me on to the book. And it's a hilarious story. Hopefully he'll share it with us. We'll take a quick break and be back. 720 WGN. Radio 720 WGN. Matt Bubala here with you from the Allstate Showcase Studio. We're speaking with Rafe Bartholomew. He is the author of 2 and 2, McSorley's, My Dad and Me. Rafe, I want to talk to you about bigger things like the bar and the history and what it means. But before we get to the news at the top of the hour here, I have to ask you if you'll entertain us all with the story of Enema Man. What the hell is Enema Man?
Absolutely. So Enema Man becomes his own sort of McSorley's legend. He's a guy who calls a payphone in the front of the bar. And yes, it's one of the few places around the neighborhood in that part of Manhattan where you'll still find a payphone. But, he calls the payphone every week or more or less. It used to be like clockwork. Now he's, slowed down to, maybe 2 or 3 times a month. But he's a guy who calls the payphone in the front room of McSorley's every week. Usually Sunday or a Monday around 5 or 6 o'clock in the afternoon. And whoever picks up the phone, whether it's someone, one of the waiters, a bartender, a customer, he doesn't care. Whoever answers the phone, the only thing he says, or the first thing he says, is, "Your enema is ready." Always in the same sort of deadpan, slow delivery. "Your enema is ready." And then from there, he'll sort of, play with you, depending on how much you want to mess around, if you want to yell at him, if you want to, try and outwit him. He's been doing this every week for over 20 years. I remember I was a kid the first time my father came home from work in the middle of the night, and I woke up and asked him what had happened on the job. And he's like, "Weirdest thing, this guy just called and started talking about your enema is ready." And at the time, we just thought it was something funny to laugh at. But then over the years, it became this little institution where, when I started working there, I was looking forward to the first time I'd get to pick up the phone and hear the Enema Man call. And, when over the years, when he's sort of drifted away and hasn't called for a little while, we sort of start to get worried. "Oh no, I hope nothing happened to the Enema Man. I hope he calls this week." So he is this sort of weird member of the McSorley's family who to our knowledge, we've never met. He has never identified himself if he's been inside the bar. Sometimes it seems like he could be somewhere nearby and looking into the bar. But he also might just be good at guessing details like that. So we don't really know who he is. We just know that he's part of the place, and he's been part of the place calling and offering enemas for a very long time.
Well, you do mention in the story that, there were a couple of times, at least one time you guys said something to him, and then he said, "Well, ask that couple in the booth," or something like that, as if he was looking in the windows, right?
Yes. He's good he'll make a remark like that that gives you the feeling that he might have an apartment sort of across the street or a block away, somewhere where he'd be able to look in and see part of the what's happening in the bar. But he could also just be good at what he does and say things that are he can sort of guess will be true without getting too far.
Sure.
Extended. I that's one thing I have not. I've not tried to catch him in the lie because every time I try to talk back to him, he thinks better on his feet than I do.
Now, you mentioned in the story though that in the washroom once you saw it written on the stall, "Enema Man was here."
Recently, this was. This was in the spring when I was back. Someone had written in the back of the stall door in the bathroom, "Enema Man was here." And that's one of those things where was it the Enema Man? It certainly could have been, was it one of the bartenders or one of the waiters on a slow night, kind of bored, wants to mess around and wrote it just to sort of, you know, have a laugh with everyone who's there. Now, hopefully no one would do that, you know, deface their own place. But could have been a customer. It could have been the real Enema Man. It could have been anyone. It's sort of hard to tell. I hope it was the real thing. It's hard to imagine that after all those years, he'd have actually never have set foot inside the bar. You know, he just has never identified himself.
Do you hope that someday you do find out who it is, or is it, you know, like, I hope that someday we find out about Amelia Earhart and D.B. Cooper. Do you hope that someday you know who Enema Man was?
I guess, you know, it goes, I see both ways of it. I mean, when you ask me, would it be great to sort of figure out finally who he was and maybe, you know, learn a little bit about him beyond just, you know, an Enema Man, put a name to him and hear where he lived or where he was from, what he did, stuff like that. I mean, that would be really, that'd be cool to sort of finally, you know, answer those questions. But at the same time, nothing can sort of live up to the mystery he is, he's the mystique he's built over the commitment of, 20 solid years of prank calling to the same phone in New York. So you can't, I mean, it's that's a streak that deserves some respect too.
He also mentioned in the story that when your dad was first telling the story, it's kind of like, as a weirdo and then kind of annoying, but then your dad built this begrudging respect for him that, you know, this guy really sticks to his thing and he does it. And you guys all started looking forward to it, right?
Yeah. Well, certainly, definitely, because it started as something like, well, you know, you're never going to believe what happened. Then he kept doing it and sort of, you know, got under everybody's skin. Cause it's like, all right, we get the joke, buddy. You know, you don't need to do this every week. And then through, you know, sheer consistency and determination, it became like a fact of life. So it's not even, you know, you don't even think of it as a prank call. You're just sort of like, oh, what time is it? Enema Man calling. Great. You know, go get it. So yeah, he really is, you know, again, you sort of have to respect, you know, anyone willing to keep that up for, you know, a few years would be pretty impressive, let alone, you know, now more than 20.
We're speaking with Rafe Bartholomew. The book 2 and 2, McSorley's, My Dad and Me, is out in hardback. You can find out about more about Rafe at RafeBartholomew.com. When we come back, a little more with Rafe about life in a bar, growing up with your dad in a bar, and the relationship that you build there. This is Chicago's very own 720 WGN Chicago and WGNRadio.com. If you're an Amazon Echo user, just say play WGN Radio. Here's the 3 a.m. news. Thank you, Roger. 3:07 a.m. Matt Bubala here with you on 720 WGN. Coming up after the 4 a.m. news, if you were asked to be in a wedding and you knew the wedding was a mistake, would you say something to your friend? Somebody did that. We'll learn what happened to them. I want to hear what happened when you did it as well. But right now, Rafe Bartholomew is on the phone with us. 2 and 2, McSorley's, My Dad and Me, is the book. Rafe, how is McSorley's doing these days? You said it's, is it on the east side in New York City?
Yeah, it's on East 7th Street between 2nd and 3rd Avenues, so right there in the East Village. And still, you know, I mean, it's because, you know, the bars in my lifetime has always done well. Mm-hmm. You know, it's an institution in the city at this point in time, and all of the, you know, just about any tourist book written in any language you can think of, McSorley's usually makes an appearance there. So you get the business is, you know, a healthy mix of people from sort of all over the country and all over the world who are coming in to check out the bar. You know, the handful of regulars who, you know, the way New York goes, probably don't actually live too close to McSorley's anymore because it's become too expensive to stay around that part of town, but have remained dedicated enough to still show up, even if it might not be as convenient as it was probably when they started going there. You know, and also it's right next to NYU, so there's always been a big, a pretty big college crowd in there, especially on weekends. You know, one of the cool things about the bar is it can feel like a very different place depending on when you go there. You know, if you happen to stop in during the afternoon or on a Sunday night, when it can be sort of dreamy and sleepy in there because it's more quiet. Yeah. You can look around and sort of really take in the history of the place. And then if you jump in at like a prime, weekend or Thursday night, It's just like it's just such a zoo, you know. I mean, people are singing, people are singing "Take Me Out to the Ball Game" for no reason every half hour, and screaming, and there's, you know, you can't hear anything other than people's voices and you know, clanking glasses, and they're both sort of great. They're just two different, very, very different sides of two different faces to the place.
You know, I feel that most kids grow up with their relationship with their dads, if it's a regular, you know, normal relationship, idolizing their dads at a young age, and growing into a sort of a teenage, early youth where they're not going to be like their dad, or they rebel against their dad a little bit. You looked forward to your dad coming home and telling you stories. Did your bond always remain close? Were there some distant years and now you've come back? I mean, what was the arc of your story with your dad?
Sure. Well, my father and I, we have always been close. Him and my mother got together, it was my mom's third marriage. So, and my father's first, so I was his first kid, and he always, you know, because he was working nights, it sort of, you know, gave him a schedule that he could spend a lot of time with me as a kid, which made us closer, and he'd bring me to the bar and stuff. And all that said, of course, you know, yeah, growing up, we definitely went at each other, or I went at him. Probably, I doubt he really felt the need to, like, you know, try to piss me off like I must have done to him. We definitely had those moments. I think for whatever reason, the bar sort of remains sort of like the safe or like the sacred spot where that sort of never really intruded on things. Where no matter what kind of stuff I would be mad at him about, or kind of, you know, have just want to instigate with him about in the rest of my life, it would usually be around something like basketball or schoolwork or those kind of things. Whereas, you know, no matter how much, you know, if we you know, say we got into, I picked a fight with him, we got into some big old argument on a Sunday afternoon before he headed to work Sunday night, or, you know, around 2-3 a.m. when he gets back home, I would sort of be up and still be, you know, wanting to hear about what happened at McSorley's, sort of hear about the bar, even when other stuff might have been going on between us. So that was always sort of like, the safe ground for us.
Mm. Now, your dad only works occasionally now. Do you guys still chat now that you're on the other coast? Will you still chat about McSorley's?
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, it's always, you know, we're always, especially I spent, about 5 years between like 2008 and 2013, 2014, working fairly regularly behind the bar, and also as a waiter sometimes wherever they needed me. I'm familiar with the entire cat, you know, like, with the word, you know, more familiar than I was even before with, how the place works and just, you know, how everyone interacts. So yeah, every time we talk, you know, it's usually what's going on, you know, who's fighting with who, you know, who got into an argument last week, what's going on, you know, who's new, who's old, who's coming back, who's threatening to quit and actually won't, you know, all that kind of stuff.
What is the bar like itself as far as the people that are regular or that come in? Is it a place where people go and talk politics, or is it a place to escape from all that and just have a beer and talk more about family and relationships?
I think you get all types there, especially, you know, for better or worse, you know, people can't stop talking about politics right now. And I think that that applies to, you know, McSorley's and any other public space. But it's a mix, and I think people are pretty, you know, they sort of, well, you know, one nice thing about the bar, when it's a little bit, you know, well, when it's very crowded, or even if it's just a little bit crowded, is that, you know, it's very common for people just to be seated together. We have large tables that'll fit, you know, 8-12 people, when makes sense, groups get just randomly put together and sort of a lot of the time end up having these interesting common bonding over the ale, over the place, over something despite being from different countries, different parts of town, different states. You know, you sort of get thrown in there with somebody you never thought you'd end up speaking to, and end up having a great time doing it. And so, you know, I think people, you know, it's the whole range of subjects that people will talk about in a bar. You know, a lot of it is sex and family and, you know, heartache and joy and all the and politics and, you know, pretty much anything else that people tell stories about.
What about for your dad himself? Is he part psychologist? I mean, bartenders tend to be the ones who get the stories poured to them or their hearts, you know, laid out on a table and asked for advice. Has your dad had to do a lot of that over the years?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, you know, especially with, you know, the sort of the customers who he knows well have been coming in and will tell, you know, talk to them. I think he likes playing that role with young people. A lot of my close friends over the years, you know, whether that he's, you know, gotten to know, whether or not I happened to be in the city at that time, you know, they would stop into the bar, or in some cases had stayed at my house and for periods of time. And he always sort of enjoyed sort of talking to people, sort of trying to find their way and you know, explaining, I don't know, whatever, you know, just sort of helping them make those kind of decisions, talking them through it. You know, and like anyone else, there are times when, you know, he's heard the same story, 17 times from the same customer, and he wouldn't mind never hearing it again. But you know, he knows how to work through that, and he certainly has a great ability to read, I think, and understand people, whether they're talking to him or not, just because, you know, he's spent his entire career and life basically dealing with the folks. You know, I mean, I've always just seeing just this great buffet of humanity walk before him, hundreds of times a year.
Has the bar changed over the years with the times? Like, are they serving a bunch of IPAs and weird stuff like that now, or is the bar stay the bar?
No, the bar definitely stays the bar. McSorley's, throughout its history, has only served light and dark McSorley's ale. We don't serve any, you know, we don't. So the menu is real tight. There's no spirits, no wine, you know, no Jameson, wow. No Irish whiskey.
So I can't even
ale, light or dark.
Get out of here. So if I come and say I want a Bud Light, they'll say nope, light or dark. That's it.
Yeah, exactly. They'll say, you know, depending on, you know, who you're speaking to, they'll, you know, sometimes they'll explain it. Sometimes they'll just look at you and say light or dark until you get it. There's a handwritten sign that's been above the bar for probably that sign. I mean, probably been up there close to 100 years, and it's, you know, today is special, light or dark McSorley's ale. And the only thing that's changed and gone up a bit over the years is the price up there. But
if I wanted a shot, or if I wanted a glass of wine, or I wanted bourbon or scotch, none of that is available. It's light or dark.
Yeah, you're in the wrong place. I mean, you know, that's this.
Now that's really amazing. I had no idea. So 163 years, you got two choices for a drink. You get light or dark. Is there a menu? Is it, because you said you waiter too? Is there a food menu?
Yeah, the place has always served food. It has the kitchen was expanded in 1986, which is, like, you know, recent by McSorley's standards. We make a very good burger that's very affordable by lower Manhattan standards. And then a lot of, you know, other bar food, fries, chili, you know, corned beef hash, all that kind of stuff. The distinctive menu item food wise at McSorley's is the cheese plate, which is a sleeve of saltine crackers, slices of sharp cheddar cheese, and sliced up raw onion that we serve with a very spicy, almost horseradishy mustard. And that's something that's been served really as long as the bar has been around. John McSorley is one of his original mottos for the bar, which in his time was open only to men. was good ale, raw onions, and no ladies. I don't know how successful a bar would be operating like that these days, but you know, the raw onions have stuck around the entire 163 years.
Oh my gosh, that's crazy! And either light or dark. That's and it's McSorley's ale. So are they brewing it there?
No, it's luckily we've been lucky enough to be doing enough business over the years to always get a sort of regional brewery to let us put in an order of our own on the side that gets that they'll make to our specifications and deliver to us every week. The brewery has changed changes every 10 years depending on weird consolidation of the brewing business, but we've been lucky enough to always find someone to work with on it.
So they kind of were the original craft brewery, even though they're not making it there. It's an original recipe. I mean, it's not just something that's dumped in there. It's your guys' recipe, right?
Yeah, it is. And I think it has been tweaked over the years, and it is not. It's not quite a guarded secret must. It has to be made to these precise specifications recipe. The spirit of McSorley's is less, a craft connoisseurship thing than just sort of enjoying a good pair, since they always come in pairs, but a good mug of ale, whether it's light or dark, whichever people prefer, at a pretty, cheap price.
So the recipe might not always be the same, but it's either light or dark. As long as it comes out light or dark out the tap, then it's fine, right?
That is right.
Now, you say it comes in pairs, and the title is 2 and 2. What does that mean? When I order a beer, I get two?
Yes, unless you're willing to put up a hell of an argument saying you just want one, you get two. They serve... They've always been served in pairs, usually and they've always been in so smallish mugs. Like the current mugs are 8.5 ounces each. So that's why you get you add two up and it's about a pint. So it makes sense in terms of that, and it's just always been that way. You two at a time, and tradition sort of just gets hardened there. You keep running everything exactly the same way because that's the way it was, and it makes working at the place one of the distinct parts of working at McSorley's, and people know us for it. You learn to hold 20, 24, 26 mugs at the same time. To deliver them to tables they crash down on the table, make a huge noise, and yeah. Everyone goes crazy because you've never seen so much ale arrive in two handfuls in their lives.
God. All right. So when you go in, light or dark, what are you ordering?
The 2 and 2 in the book refers to sort of my favorite order, which is too light and too dark. I like to mix them. I like to get, I like to have one of each, and you can always do that, thanks to the pair ordering system. I'd just say we sell a little bit more of the light just because I think that's not too surprising.
Yeah.
It's a little easier to convince people, especially when they first come in to try the light. It's, sure. They're like, oh yeah, I'll stick with the light. But the dark is very nice. It's not as heavy as a stout as a Guinness. It's a little bit more of a porter, and it's a little bit sweet and nutty. It's great. So I always mix it up. I get 2 and 2.
On East 7th Street between 2nd and 3rd Avenue, you'll find McSorley's. Rafe Bartholomew is the author of 2 and 2, McSorley's, My Dad and Me. Maybe we'll get lucky enough someday. Just ask for Bart if we're in there, and hopefully he'll happen to be working. Is that the best way, Rafe?
That is a good way, and it's a pretty good bet when he gets called in. It's often on Sundays and Monday nights these days. Bart is a tall 6'3 guy, getting on in years, but still in great shape, with glasses and sort of an unmistakable handlebar mustache. It's been there my entire life.
What are you working on next?
I'm still sort of out here, you know, promoting, selling the book, doing, you know, freelance editing. I used to work for a ESPN website as a features editor and magazine editor. So, you know, sort of do pick up a lot of that work on the side while figuring out, gee, do I have to try and write another book again? I hope not, although it would be great, but it's a lot of work.
Yeah, I imagine it is. Any hope that something else happens with 2 and 2? You're out in L.A. Has it been optioned? Anything like that? Any talk?
Sure. I mean, I think that folks are reading it with that in mind, and I've heard some possibilities of it getting optioned for TV or movies, which would be great if it happens. I mean, that world is such a crapshoot, and despite me having lived in California for a few years, still kind of feels foreign to me. So I'm not getting my hopes up too high, but that'd be great if it happens.
Rafe Bartholomew. So great to chat with you on the phone. Visit RafeBartholomew.com or pick up 2 and 2, McSorley's, My Dad and Me, in bookstores and online now. Thanks for jumping on the phone, Rafe. I hope we stay in touch.
Yeah, me too. Thank you so much, man. This is great.
But have a great morning. Rafe Bartholomew, 2 and 2. Now, next time I'm in New York City, I don't get to New York City very often, but I definitely want to go and have... That's so great, though. Light or dark? Can you imagine a bar opening up today? People, whoever's investing in, would go, what are you, crazy? You need shots. You need this. You need wings. Light or dark? Raj, we go to, so after we do the remote at Ishnala.
Right.
We're going to New York City.
Okay.
We're going to New York City. We're going to do a remote from McSorley's.
Okay.
And what are you drinking, light or dark?
You know what? I have an affinity for dark. And that's only within recent years. I just like the boldness of it.
Yeah, I'd have to go light.
Okay.
Just because I'm soft. I can't drink real beer. You know, I drink Corona. People make fun of me all the time. That's fine.
Good Lord.
I like a good watery beer. That's how I am.
Well, I'm not going to laugh. I still drink Hams.
Hams.
Yeah.
From the land of sky blue waters.
That was the first beer my dad let me drink.
Hams.
Did I tell you about this when I went to baseball games? Yeah.
Holy cow.
Oh, yeah. I could get it at the bowling alley where I bowl. You can get it at L. Woods with a nice skirt steak dinner.
I can't believe they still make Hams.
Yeah.
Man.
And a lot more places are starting to carry it now, too.
That's amazing. Yeah. That is amazing.
But, you know, the story, my dad took me to baseball games over at Wrigley Field, and Wrigley Field used to serve Hams back in the day.
Yeah. I think that's how we saw the commercials so much growing up, right?
Well, because they were baseball games.
Yeah.
But I was fairly young. We're not talking, you know.
You were under 21 is what you're saying.
I was under 21. I was way under 21.
And Dad would let you
And Dad would let me because they would pour the beers real fast.
Yeah.
So you got a lot of foam.
Yeah.
So my dad said, here, you can go ahead and, you know, suck the foam off the top, probably because he didn't want to have to deal with it.
I don't need that foam. That's what I got my kid here for.
Yeah, but he said, but don't drink the beer. And not until I got older and actually got some brains did I realize it doesn't matter whether I drink the beer or the liquid or not, there's beer in the foam. And I was always wondering why I felt so happy.
When you got older, did you
games.
Start thinking, well, he's not going to know if there's a quick slug or two here?
Yeah, well, yeah. I didn't wait till I was older.
Yeah, too funny. Too funny. So that's our second. So we got a lot to talk to Stephanie
Todd
about.
We've got to go on the road.
Man, we got to get a sponsor for the show, Raj. A
couple of them, I think. This is starting to get expensive.
Write this off a little bit, yeah.
Yeah.
312-981-7200. News is next, 720 WGN. Thank you, Jess. I was just asking Jess, who wrote Angela's Ashes? Frank McCourt wrote Angela's Ashes. Malachi McCourt, Frank's brother. I can't look up just what Malachi McCourt's book or books were. So Angela's Ashes, very famous book by Frank McCourt. A wonderful, beautiful book if you've never read it.
Yeah,
Angela's
nice movie.
Ashes.
Very well done movie version.
I never saw the movie.
Oh, you haven't?
I did not.
Oh, yeah.
But I did read the book, and it was wonderful. Malachi McCourt, Frank's brother. Now, Frank McCourt, very serious writer, beautiful book about his mother and her life. Malachi McCourt, like I think maybe the youngest brother out of all the kids, was kind of a rollicking, drinking, writing New Yorker. And this bar seems like the type of place that Malachi would have been. What was Malachy's book, just when you get a chance? M-A-L-A-C-H-Y, I believe, Malachy McCourt. But I just love the idea of a place like McSorley's and people writing stories about families and generations.
Hanging out there. And...
What is there a famous one that pops up? Read me a couple of the titles. It was probably like 95 to 98, somewhere in there, Malachy's book. Actually, between 97 and 2000, probably. Malachy wrote a lot of books. But he came out with a book after Frank. And
didn't Frank come out with a second one?
I'm sure he did.
Yeah, I thought he did.
Angela's Ashes are what made him blow up.
Well,
right,
right.
It's probably like an Oprah.
But didn't he come out with one on teaching?
Well, he was a New York City school teacher.
Right,
for
and he came out with one after Angela's Ashes. He came out with one about being a teacher. Are we going to the librarian?
Well, I'm librarying it up myself right now, Rog. Let's Malachy McCourt. What was the old our Dewey Decimal cards? A Monk Swimming. There you go. A Monk Swimming was his kind of semi-autobiography. Biographical book. About growing up with his family in New York City. A Monk Swimming, which comes from, what prayer would that be from?
A prayer?
Yeah. Hail Mary, full of grace, Lord is with thee, blessed art thou.
Oh, see, you got the heads up on me.
Blessed art thou, a monk swimming.
Oh.
That's why the title is A Monk Swimming.
See,
all right.
I wouldn't know that.
I was
Bridget
on time for news,
but...
and then I started talking, and then I blew it altogether. 3:33 in the morning.
You were okay at 3.
Yeah,
you were.
2 wasn't so good, but that's okay. All right, 3:33 in the morning. Here's what I do want to talk about next. We brought this up at the end of Patty's show, if you weren't with us. Let's just say it's going to happen. The bomb is going to drop.
All right.
Right here where we're at in the Showcase studio, not going to turn out so well for us.
Doggone it.
Yeah. Now, if we were out at the transmitter, like Steve Bertrand was during Y2K on that New Year's Eve, I was down here in the studios with Mary June. I was on call just in case it went down. Steve Bertrand was broadcasting from the transmitter all night long, way out in the Western Burbs, just in case things went wrong.
Right.
As a backup plan. So if it's going to go down, do we want to be here and have the quick goodbye? Or do we want to be out in the Western Burbs and see what happens? Let's talk about that next. 312-981-7200. Here's the headlines with Roger Badish. Morning, everybody. Matt Bubala with you, 720 WGN. Boy, that's a quick bump. Those bumps got to be a little longer. Those bumps got to stay a little longer. I want to ride that thing a little bit.
Like a wave.
Yes. Yes. Like a wave, Roger. By the way, big eclipse coming up in what?
Yeah.
How many days? 10 days from now.
21st, something like that. 22nd, 21st.
I'm thinking about driving downstate with the kids.
That'd be nice. Well, we got a whole crew going down there.
I heard Patty and...
Dave Schwann and Steve Krasanich, who went to school there.
They're going to go down to Carbondale?
Yeah.
And that's almost in the path of totality?
Yeah.
That sounds like a great band.
It's like about 93%, 96% totality, something like that.
I think that sounds like a band that Steve Cochran would say.
Yeah, right.
That
was my first band.
Totality.
Yeah. I played tambourine in that band.
In Path of Totality?
Yeah.
You were awesome back then. by the way, so you mentioned a lot of sports news.
Yeah.
And here's the other sports news, which I'm, of course, very excited about because our little all-star team won the state tournament. The 11-year-olds, our 10-year-old team won the state tournament. If we had been 12-year-olds and won the state tournament.
You would have gone.
To the Little League Regional, the Great Lakes Regional Tournament. And in the Great Lakes Regional Tournament, the Illinois representative, Hinsdale, Illinois, which won the 12-year-olds, they are playing in the Great Lakes Regional Championship game today at 4 p.m.
Oh, man. Where's that going to be held? Do you know?
It's in Indianapolis, a beautiful complex outside of Indianapolis.
Nice.
But it will be aired live on ESPN.
Oh.
ESPN is airing all these Little League games.
Yeah.
You can talk on air. Just always quit saying things in my ear. When we're talking, just talk on the air. Just jump in.
And
just
I feel like I'm left out of the conversation because I don't hear
I think
that
you're
in
hurting
my ear.
Roger's feelings.
I'm.
Go ahead. Say what you just said.
Just go on.
Are you going?
I am not going. I tried to talk Colleen into it. She said, we're not driving down to Indianapolis to watch that game. She's like, I am so done driving hours and hours to watch baseball games.
Aww.
So no. I want to do it, but it's on ESPN, so it's not like I'm
but it could be history in making. It's like being at the World Series.
Yeah, but it's not our team. If it was a Tri-Cities Little League team, yes,
but
we would
close
be
enough.
Down. Hinsdale? Forget those.
You and Roger can both come to the Lake House.
Just invited my family to the lake house. As well,
really?
Which is
lake
very
house?
Sweet.
What
yeah,
lake
and
house?
Then we could have gone to the game, too, because she's got a lake house. It's not your lake house, right?
My boyfriend's family.
So wait, you invited me and my family to your boyfriend's family's lake house?
They're nice.
You're feeling pretty comfortable with this boyfriend, aren't you? He does not know what he's gotten himself into, clearly.
I hope you got enough room.
How long have you two been dating?
A year.
Aww.
After 1 year, I'm just inviting people you don't know to your family's lake house.
He knows all about you, don't
Did
worry.
Did you run that by him before you threw out that invitation to me this week?
Good things. People are meeting us at our house at 6 a.m., and we're going down there.
You noticed that Jess called it our house.
Yeah.
Wow.
Interesting. Wow, this is getting serious.
On somebody's half, it is.
Yeah.
We haven't spoken with him.
Right. Hopefully. I think this is
just leaving stuff in drawers. Like, yep, part mine.
I'm making a prediction right now.
Oh boy!
12 months from now.
Oh boy!
We may be talking to a missus.
How old are you, Jess?
Oh, listen. Well, did you hear her?
Yeah, there was no
did you hear
in that
her?
Voice. How old are you?
I'll be 26 next month.
All right, 26. Yeah. That's good.
I'm just saying. We'll just mark the tape. Now, I gave myself a whole 12 months.
So you guys have been dating a year.
Correct.
So at the age of 26, you're thinking, I'd like him to make this more serious. And let me ask you this, Jess. And you did not sign up for this, but boy, you just walked right into all this. And luckily, Jess has probably not talked to my previous producers to know how this is going to go. However, you're in here now. So now you're stuck. Do you drop hints like, here's the kind of ring I'd really like to have?
No.
Have you ever told him this is the kind of ring I would like to have?
I have not.
So he doesn't know pear shape, diamond, round, whatever. He doesn't have any clue.
No.
Good. I'm glad to hear that. Have you told him at what age? What kind of let's get married hints are you dropping?
None.
Not one. You've never said, boy, wouldn't it be great to get married in the summer? Or I'd really like our wedding to be blank.
No, it's different because he's been married before.
Oh, he has. Okay.
Whoa.
But you haven't.
Correct.
All How old is he?
He turned 29 on Wednesday.
Okay. So that's interesting because he's been married before. Is he kind of like skittish about the whole idea or is he still cool with the idea? Or do you guys just never talk about that?
We have. It's not like it was a bad breakup or anything. It was very mutual. So.
And they didn't have kids? Right?
No kids.
That's a good time to get divorced. Not that there's ever a good time to get divorced, but before you have kids, it's a really good time to get divorced. Yeah. Okay, we really just went all sorts of sideways there. Anyways, Hinsdale.
No, you're just trying to, because I made a prediction and you're just trying to
you
get a little
inside. You did make a
inside.
Prediction. You did throw that down there, didn't you?
I did.
Are you going to tell the boyfriend that Roger predicted? See, that's a great guy. See, I don't want to encourage you to start forcing the marriage conversation.
Sure, put it all
I think
on
that's
me.
Really not a good way to handle the relationship. However, if you're feeling like forcing it a little, you can just so casually say, you know, it's a funny thing, honey. Last night on the show, Roger said he bets within 12 months we're married.
And add
and
this
then,
to that.
And then see if he screams and runs out the room or if he says, wow, really? Huh. Isn't that interesting?
But add this to that. Roger was 24 when he got married. You guys are like, I mean, wow, you're getting old.
I am getting old, Roger.
See?
Terrible, Roger.
Huh?
Don't start that.
I just, look, I'm a little older.
I was 26.
I know some of the ways of the, see? Actually, I married an older woman.
So did I.
Ooh, see?
7 months older.
Yeah, Bridget's 5 months older. And then I did a great thing. Actually, we did a great thing. Mm-hmm. So that I don't forget when I get older and more senile. I know my place. Within 7 days in February, we celebrate Valentine's Day, her birthday, and our anniversary.
Did you plan that out on the wedding date and stuff?
No. Well, her birthday and Valentine's Day were already set.
You couldn't do much about that. That just kind of happened. You're right.
Yeah, that was set already.
I mean, you're not so old that you had a say in when Valentine's Day
was. No, that happened. And her birthday was set, like, long time.
Hopefully.
So, but the wedding just kind of happened, and I didn't think much of it at the time that it was within 7 days.
Right. But it's worked out pretty well for you.
It's worked out pretty well, except I can't get away with one present.
You can't just do one big one that covers all three?
Not if I value my life. Nope.
Take notes, Jess. This is how marriage works.
And doesn't matter how long you've been married. Mm-hmm. If you don't do something special for Valentine's Day or the birthday...
See, that is so not true in our house.
No.
We have never, for each other, both sides, never done anything really for Valentine's Day. Believe Valentine's Day is such a forced upon us holiday.
Doesn't matter in our place.
Well.
Oh, man. You better get something.
You got to know who you're married to, and you know
that's
who
true.
You're married to.
I do.
We do so little for any of that stuff. Mm. We should do more. I try to do more. But.
Well, you guys are busy. You know.
Hinsdale, Illinois will play Michigan for the Great Lakes Regional Championship starting at 4 o'clock our time today, 5 o'clock Eastern time, which is what Indy is on. But at 4 o'clock, Hinsdale plays Michigan for the right to go to Williamsport and be part of the Little League World Series.
Go Hinsdale.
Yes, go Hinsdale. And I am ESPN is playing, and this is all that is on in our house right now. The boys get up in the morning. They turn on the TV, and we just had Little League Baseball on all day today. There were elimination games on all day on ESPN on Friday, and we just watched them all day long. It was fascinating. It's so much fun to watch these kids playing and how, the good plays they make, the bad plays they make, how bad the umpiring is.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, my God. Some of these umpires are calling strikes so far out of the strike zone, it drives you insane.
I'm surprised you have a tongue left.
Why?
Well, how many times you have to bite your tongue?
Well, I'm watching
you
on
see...
TV. I can curse at the TV. It's fine.
Well, oh, okay, that's true.
Yeah, I have no problem with
that. Sorry
at all.
About that. I thought like you were.
No, but my kids always joke because you know when these games are on TV, they mic up the coaches.
Oh.
And when the coaches come to the mound, a lot of times they're listening in. And
yikes. You got to be careful.
I would. My children would tell you that I'm somewhat infamous for what I say when I get to the mound at times.
Really?
I've known to put out a word or two that you would not want rebroadcast on television.
Kind of colorful language?
Type of colorful language that would get me suspended here. Yes.
Wow.
And, you know.
And this was what age kids? 11-year-old?
I started when they were about 7. All right. But, I think I don't drop any words until they're at least 9.
Oh, that's nice.
But, Raj, when you're dealing with 9, 10, 11, 12-year-old boys, a well-placed word that they don't hear all the time does startle them to life.
Okay.
I'm dead serious about that. You say, we're going to go kick some ass.
Yeah.
And suddenly these boys look at you like, oh, my God, are we kicking ass?
Well, that's not
Is that what we're doing? Are we old enough to do that? Wow. And it sort of, like, does something to them.
All right.
And I always say, your parents don't know any of what we say in these meetings.
Yeah.
I don't know if they go tell them or not.
Are you going to claim lawyer privilege or lawyer-client privilege?
You know,
I don't think that's going to work.
Client privilege? Yeah, no, it's not. If I get in trouble, I get in trouble.
Yeah.
But it is what it is. But so Hinsdale. So a couple of years ago, we're watching the Little League World Series, and this one team's plan. I don't remember who it was. Things are going wrong.
Uh-huh.
They're making errors or pitching bad, whatever. Coach comes out of the dugout, comes to the mound. Catcher walks out with him. Infield walks in. Right before he gets to the mound, catcher says, you're mic'd, coach.
Uh-oh.
And the coach says, thanks, and then starts talking to him.
Uh-huh.
And we all died laughing in our house because we totally knew that the coach had probably said to the catcher, if I come to the mound, remind me that I have a microphone.
Yeah, right.
Because it's a good reminder to give him that, dude, you know how you normally curse at us like crazy?
Mm-hmm.
You're on national TV. Don't do that right now. Right. Good. Thanks, son. Here we go. Let's tighten things up, boys. You know those things they'd usually say? Run them through your head right now and let's go.
Funny.
Oh, man. Gosh. So very excited to watch that and then watch the Little League World Series next week. It's a lot of fun. It's really fun to watch the kids and the crazy parents and the coaches and just all that stuff. Just all that stuff. So much
fun.
That'd
be nice.
Okay, so Raj.
Yo.
The bomb is coming.
Okay.
Where do you want to be?
Where do I want to be? Well,
so let's assume
you gave me the choice.
If you stay here.
Right.
In 14 minutes, we're saying goodbye and that's it.
All right. I'm dust.
And it's, yes. And it's dust instantaneous. We're not going to suffer. No, anything. Just.
Right.
But if Todd calls and says, hey, Raj, Matt, get out to the transmitter because we need to keep broadcasting because that is our responsibility and letting people know what's going on. So we're headed out there and you're going to survive the first wave and then good luck to you.
I'm a company man if he tells me to get out there.
Right.
I'll get out there.
What would your choice be, though? And let's take, like, Bridget and families and kids. Let's take all of that out of it. Let's take those considerations. Well, let's just take the consideration of, you know, you'd say, well, Bridget's up in Evanston. I don't want to not be
right,
by her.
Right, right.
If we're going again. You know, let's assume that somehow they're out of the equation. Either they're all going to be with us or not or whatever. And even that, because then I would think about, well, do I want my kids to, you know, I don't want, you know, I've at least lived 45 years and, you know, seen some things. So if it happens, it happens. That's, I don't want that for the kids who haven't had a chance to live their life yet. Right.
Right.
So take all that out of the equation. Just if it's going to happen.
Right.
Would you want instantaneous or let's survive the first wave and let's see what happens?
Can I be Captain Kirk for a second?
You can't teleport yourself anywhere.
No. I want to rewrite the computer for the Kobayashi Maru.
I don't know what that means, Roger.
It was a computer simulation.
Is this in
for
a
Starship Enterprise? Okay. Yeah, where actually it's from the movie, but Captain Kirk was the only officer or cadet to ever beat the computer simulation. And he was asked in the movie, how'd you do it? And he says, well, I rewrote the program for the computer. So here's the deal. Tribune Tower goes down a ways underground. There's some lower floors.
Okay.
And there's a lot of cement and steel covering them. I would take a microphone with an extremely long cord on it, which I would only need for a little while because the blast would then obliterate all of the audio equipment. It would just fry everything.
Yeah.
Electronically and physically burn and fry.
You'd be off the clock quickly.
Yeah.
If the building was even still here.
Right. Well,
I'm going to assume it might not survive it.
If I went to the lower basement floors, I think I could survive and I could still broadcast. I'm going to take a wild guess. I've never been out there.
If you want to survive, why not just go out to the transmitter?
Well, but
not be right here.
But if you're asking me if I'm going to be here or at the transmitter.
I'm asking what you want to do. Do you want to instantaneously be done or do you want to survive the first wave, not knowing whether you're going to just, be killed 20 minutes later or survive and be radiated to death or survive it, but there's no food, you can't breathe, all that stuff.
Right. Well, it's kind of like, the commercials. You can pay me now, you can pay me later. Either way, you got to pay me.
Right.
So
but
I'm going to be gone no matter what. I think I'd like to go instantly.
Okay.
Because, I mean, I wouldn't mind trying to survive.
Mm-hmm.
But having seen, what's the movie, The Day After? The old ABC movie, remember?
Yes, that was scary.
That was extremely scary.
And my
understanding of radiation, especially since the bombs that we have now, the nuclear bombs that we have now, are like, I'm not sure, the exponential higher power than the bombs in Nagasaki and Hiroshima. I don't think being out at the transmitter is going to make much difference. Seriously.
There was a very interesting thing let's assume it's from North Korea. The whole thing could be a dud, and they're miniaturizing it.
I'm not chancing anything.
Flying over, dropping it.
Yeah, well.
The movie The Day After.
Right.
I recall very little of it, but I recall this. The bombs were coming. I believe it was Soviet missiles, probably, right? Because that was a big concern at the time. Yeah. All these people, I can't remember if they knew they were coming or if they didn't know they were coming.
If there was a warning.
But they were driving, like people on an expressway or highway, and all the cars died.
Right. Well, because the electrical systems. It's an electrical, that's what I was saying about the equipment.
But I thought it
here.
Was before, the people were still driving. I thought it was before an explosion had happened.
Well, it couldn't be. The explosion has to happen for that to happen.
And then it would, but these people weren't all obliterated. They were out standing on a highway and all the cars died.
It can't happen before the bomb explodes.
Could it have exploded really far away and while they haven't been affected immediately by the blast? Something happens that shuts
the electromagnetic or whatever the current is, the electrical current that is that emanates from that, that is formed from that. It's kind of like static electricity.
And
that is a byproduct of it.
That's crazy.
Yeah. Wow, it had a 46 rating, 62% share of the viewing audience. This is in 1983.
God, I remember that so well.
More than 100 million people and 39 million households watched this.
Seriously?
Seriously.
Oh, my gosh.
Film postulates a fictional war between NATO forces and the Warsaw Pact that rapidly escalates into a full-scale nuclear exchange between the U.S. and the Soviet Union. The action itself focuses on the residents of Lawrence, Kansas and Kansas City, Missouri, as well as several family farms situated near nuclear missile silos.
Yeah, so they're far enough away from where blasts would probably happen in the country. Okay. All right, we're going to take a quick break. We're going to do the news. And then, if you knew, such diverse topics, if you knew that friends of yours getting married, it was not a good idea, do you speak up? We'll talk to somebody who did after the news next, 720 WGN. Thank you, Roger Badish.
You're welcome.
Matt Bobala with you, 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate Showcase Studio on the Magnificent Mile. Joining us on the phone line, waiting ever so patiently, is Derek Hills. He is a playwright and an essayist, and he wrote a guest column in the soloish column section of the Washington Post at WashingtonPost.com. I read it this week or a couple of weeks ago, and Jess was able to track Derek down and get him to jump on the phone very early in the morning in D.C. Good morning, Derek.
Good morning, Derek. Good morning.
Where are you at?
Oh, I'm ensconced in my living room.
Okay. It sounded like you were in the, I don't know, hospital waiting room is what came to mind for a second as things were bouncing off your walls in there. So thanks for jumping up on the phone early with us. I'm guessing you didn't stay up all night because you're not 22 anymore.
No, I took a little nap.
A good boy. All right, good. So you wrote a guest column for the soloish piece in the Washington Post, and you didn't tell him before he got married. We've been talking about this kind of throughout the show, so people kind of already know what we're talking about. Do you tell somebody when you know that the marriage is not going to work out? You didn't say anything beforehand, but you said as you were tasked with writing something on the car before they pulled away, you wanted to write something sarcastic because you felt this is not going to work out. But you didn't say anything to the friend before the marriage actually happened, right?
That's true.
But
yeah, I didn't feel like that was, who does that? No one does that. So I wasn't going to be that guy at that point.
It is rare that somebody speaks up and says that, and that probably never really turns out well because, you know, somebody's in love and then the buddy says, you know what, that's a really bad idea. You're not going to see that because you're blinded by the relationship that you're in. So do you think that there's ever a time, I guess if it was abusive or something like that, but if it's just two people that you think, man, that's not going to work out. We probably never, they just have to learn that for themselves, right?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, my personal philosophy is that, you know, if people want to do something, you know, you should do everything you can to like facilitate that, you know, because unless it's dangerous, like you say, you know, I mean, people have to find things out for themselves. You want them to own their decision making, right? So that's how I feel about it.
But the funny thing is, like, years later, you'll tell somebody, yeah, I knew that. Well, why didn't you say something at the time? Then they'll give you that probably because then they're wishing they had known because they wasted whatever time or resources or parts of their life on something that didn't work out. This friend, the marriage, while it happened, a short time later, they hit a rough patch and he asked you for some advice, and you said, just get a divorce.
Yeah, I guess I wasn't too sensitive at that point in time. This friendship that we had, it was a very open, you know, like a very direct type of friendship. And my friend is, you know, the kind of guy who tells people things that sound like it's in confidence. And then, you know, and you feel like, wow, we're so close. And then, you know, you overhear him saying the same thing to somebody who can't possibly be as good of friends as you two are, you know, the same exact thing. So I don't know. I don't know why I felt so comfortable, but yeah, I just let it fly.
And he did not like that advice at the time, did he?
Well, he had this kind of stunned look on his face. And, you know, it's kind of when I realized that, you know, because, you know, obviously I had been thinking like, you know, they're just not right for each other, for quite some time.
Did you explain that to him? Because like you lay it out really nice in the piece that you wrote about, you know, the way they talked about each other. They never held hands. They didn't look at each other. It all makes sense as you're writing it. When you were able to coherently kind of state any of that when you're telling him, yeah, I don't think this is going to work out?
Well, you know, I tried to focus on the communication piece, and they were not communicating very well at the time.
Because she had just...
Or at all.
Yeah, she had disappeared, right? She was incommunicado for a few days.
Yeah. So it's like, you know, he had not heard from her, and, you know, I guess he had... you know, it took him some time to track her down, at least to know about her whereabouts. And, you know, so I just kind of focused on the communication aspect. I'm like, well, you know, I don't know how you can have a relationship with someone who doesn't want to talk to you. So that was kind of the, you know, I kind of laid that as the basis for my recommendation for what it was worth.
So you tell him that he's stunned. Does he walk off in a huff, or is he like, dude, you don't understand? Or is he like, all right, well, thanks. How did that part of the conversation end?
Well, we happened to be standing out on the sidewalk. It was one of those, have a few beers as a normal catch up. And then he's like, oh yeah, by the way, on the way back to his car, or, you know, and so we're standing there on the, you know, the sidewalk. It's kind of twilight. And, you know, when I said this, you know, he's like really pondering the pavement. And his reaction was rather subdued. You know, he could tell he was upset, like, you know, his eyes kind of welled up with tears a little bit. But there was none of that. There were no histrionics. It was just a rather kind of like an acknowledgement of what I had said, and kind of this, you know, like something he would ponder. You know, you could tell that was something I was like, okay, that's on the list of outcomes. Thank you.
So you get a note from him a couple weeks later. And what happened?
Well, it was a really kind of terse note. He was like, hey, you know, I just wanted to let you know that we're getting, you know, like that we've been back in touch. And, you know, we're going to work it out. I just wanted to let you know. And yeah, well, the terseness of the note, the very kind of, you know, I felt like it could have been like a telegram from some bygone era. And I just felt like, oh, I kind of screwed up there. Yeah. That was not the right way to go.
It's so tough because here you're just trying to give him advice of what you really think. Like, hey, I don't think this is going to work out. I think you should just get a divorce. But then if they get back together, that's real bad. Now you're not coming over for barbecues because you're the one that's rooting against this. And you said it shouldn't happen, but we're going to prove you wrong.
Yeah. You know, it's a little awkward. And, you know, it's funny because, you know, we've remained friends for, you know, in the aftermath, but it was never been the same.
Yeah.
And, you know, I mean, we were the kind of guys who, you know, we go out every weekend together and, you know, we'd get some greasy spoon at 3 a.m. and talk about, you know, life and what we wanted and da da da. And, you know, none of that, you know, that was the end. And once there was one moment where, you know, I can't remember exactly how it went down, but he alluded to that conversation in the twilight. And I was just like, yeah, that was, you know, it wasn't the best idea. And he just looked at me like dead in the eyes and was like, he's like, no, it wasn't. So, you know, that was a true watershed. And you can't go back.
All right. So he said that to you, no, it wasn't, when he was still married?
Yes. Yes. This was a few years on and looked like, you know, they had, you know, settled in for a long run.
Yeah. They had had a couple kids, but then.
Yeah, but then, you know, so he moved away from my town, and, you know, periodically he blows through, and we get together. And, you know, so this was one of those times. And, you know, so we go out for some beers, because that's a prerequisite for truth. And, we walk around and end up back at my place, and he's like, so, and, you know, whenever this person says, so, you know, there's going to be some bombshell news, you know, flowing forth. And, yeah, so he tells me that, he is getting divorced. And, you know, it was one of those deals where I guess I was kind of surprisingly at the time, because, you know, it just had been a while.
Yeah.
And, you know, I thought whatever they had figured out was, you know, had some staying power.
Yeah.
But at the same time, you know, I was just back to where I was years before. I'm like, no, this makes sense. So yeah, that's kind of how it happened.
So when he's telling you that, how does that go? Because the temptation, if you're really good friends, is to say, and what else would you like to tell me? Would you like to say, and you were right, or something, you know? But I imagine he's in pain. You already screwed this up once. So you're like, okay, you just say it, because I'm not saying nothing no more. That's how do you handle that?
Yeah. You know, I mean, the humble pie did not taste good the first time around. So, you know, I definitely just nodded my head and tried to be as understanding. As possible, you know. It's funny you mentioned earlier, like, you know, I have, there was this guy and then one other friend of mine who I just thought, like, going in, I was just like, this is not going to end well. And the other friend ended up getting divorced much sooner. And she was like, why didn't you tell me? You know? And I was like, I reference you to this moment in my life. I would think I was a better friend the second time around.
Yeah. So is that friend, so once they did get divorced, I know you were kind about it and stuff, but it's been a while now, I'd imagine, since it happened. Has he ever said, you know what, you were right, and I'm glad you did say something at the time. I wish I would have heeded your advice. Or I imagine since they had kids, he probably doesn't regret it now. And you know, how does he feel about what you said now?
You know, I don't think it really matters to him that much. I mean, he's been living his own life, and, you know, I think he leads a very, you know, spectacular life in so many ways. And, I don't think he, you know, to the extent he thinks about it, we've never talked about it.
All right. So Derek Hill's, advice for couples, if you see, what are the telltale signs? Because you seem to have a knack for this over the years. You watched a lot of friends get married, and you predicted a couple of divorces. And you mentioned in the article they didn't touch each other in public. They didn't look in each other's eyes a lot. When you see a couple, what are your, like, do you have three cardinal rules for these are my red flags on this relationship is not so good?
Well, yeah, people who don't, number one, people who don't seem to like being around one another. You know, I think is the absolute number one. You know, I mean, you see folks sometimes who, like, you know, where their wit kind of bends into the, you know, sarcastic or occasionally, like, you know, mean. So that to me is a big red flag. You know, like another thing, like, you know, I've noticed couples where you hang out with them and, like, you know, especially in a double date situation, and, you know, there's they seem to be more interested in interacting with the other couple more than each other. You know, for me, that sounds like a cry for help to a certain extent. You know, I like to see couples that you know, like each other so much that even in the awesome presence of another cool couple, they still are like, hey, I mean, we could ditch these people if you want, kind of feeling, you know. So I like that, and I guess, you know, this like kind of you know, I look for you know, a kind of ease together, kind of like a complementariness, if you will, that you know, that just you know, they look like not working too hard, I guess.
Yeah, that's interesting. Working too hard to try to make something out of something that isn't there. You can kind of read that and see that when it's happening in front of you. You know, it's funny. You mentioned I'm trying to think about my own marriage and things like that. And when you're with another couple, sometimes you're so excited to be out of the house and away from the kids, you are very excited to see other people. So I'm going to defend that part a little bit, because I think couples go through that. Well, it's very interesting. You can read it at WashingtonPost.com. Derek, you're a playwright and an essayist. Are there other writings of yours that people can find?
Let's see. I've done a lot of arts criticism, you know, for local theater here in D.C.
Cool.
You know, my previous essay effort has been a while, because I've been writing for stage recently, but I was a virgin until I was 27 years old. So I have a nice little story about creating the one person show called No Sex, Please. you know, it was about that. So I'm working on a one person show for next year, tentatively titled Boy of the Year, and I will be remounting No Sex, Please to support it.
Oh, very cool. Is there a website where people can follow you or learn more?
Yeah, that's right. DerekHills.com.
DerekHills.com. We don't have time to get into it now, but the No Sex Until 27, by choice or just by circumstance?
Both. Both. You know, it starts out as a choice and then it becomes circumstance. Like, it's like a vicious cycle.
Well, I'm happy for you that you sounds like you eventually broke it. And hopefully things have been going swimmingly ever since.
Yeah, it's been great. I'm very fortunate.
DerekHills.com is his website, and you can read more there, but you can read this piece. I didn't think the couple would make it. I was right, at WashingtonPost.com. Derek, thanks so much for jumping on the phone with us this morning.
Absolutely. Thank you much.
All right, man. Have a great one. So, do you tell, do you not tell? It's a really tough one, but I think Derek's right. Maybe it's never the right choice to just, I know that if it goes badly afterwards, they're going to say, like his other friend said, why didn't you tell me? But man, is it tough to pull that one out when you're seeing it happening? Because if they really love that person and they think it's going to work, that's going to put a serious strain on that relationship. Matt Bobala with you for 20 more minutes here on 720 WGN. Roger, so you know, you're mentioning the traffic, everything's good in traffic right now. When I was driving in tonight, two motorcycles blew by me on the Kennedy.
Yeah.
It had to have been, 125 miles an hour.
Yeah.
I mean, it was like, phew! Like I was doing 80, but it looked like I was standing still.
Do that on the outer drive on the weekends, too.
Insane.
Yeah.
I thought for sure, well, I'm going to come up on a wreckage here pretty soon. I don't know where they went, but man, were they flying. Two of them.
A lot of cycles come down town to Michigan Avenue, Wacker Drive area, and zip in and out of traffic many times against the light, blocking traffic. They do that also on lower Wacker Drive. That's been a problem for the last couple of summers now.
That was crazy.
Yeah. In fact, I saw, I'll find it again. I saw about another motorcycle accident actually went off the side of a road down a ways. I'll look for it. It's not safe. I took one ride on a motorcycle. I wiped out, let's put it that way.
I have never ridden on a motorcycle in my life.
I did. We had someone in the neighborhood when I was a lot younger, up in Evanston. Someone had a cycle and brought it over to the park. And we all took turns kind of trying to figure out how to drive, because you have to shift with you have to pull the clutch in with the handle and then shift with your foot. And then let the clutch out the right way. If not, the thing jumps and dies on you. And it could fall over on you, too.
Yeah.
Very dangerous, riding a motorcycle. So, that was the last time. than I did that.
The Grandpa Henry, the kid's grandpa, about 6-7 years ago, they were at a party. Friend had a motorcycle. Come on, I'll take you for a ride. They go out for a ride. A few blocks, some teenager hits them with a car.
Oh, no.
And they went skidding across. He was fine in the end, but like shoulder surgery, terrible.
Were they wearing helmets at the time?
I don't think he was wearing a helmet. He really got lucky. 815 texted a while ago, an EMP can happen from a nuclear bomb. It would hit you first if you were far enough away from it, and then you would feel the heat. An EMP, electromagnetic pulse, maybe?
Yep.
Is an EMP?
Mm-hmm.
I was complaining about the umpires in the games I was watching in the Little League regionals. And 3-3 Run says, give the umps a break. They never say how bad you guys coach.
Ooh.
That's a good point. That's a really good point.
Yeah.
But the umps are getting paid to be there. So I think that's different. We get to criticize because we're paying. Don't you think?
I'll go with the sportsman angles.
I mean, I agree. They don't sit there and moan about our egregious coaching, but
if it's an egregious call,
it's not, you know,
everyone in the whole stadium and the kids are running up to the ump
on
saying,
any of these televised games, there's instant replay in Little
League
Baseball.
Okay, that's good.
Only for the televised games because they have the TV, you know, the cameras there.
Right.
So I believe it's something like you get unlimited appeals as long as you're getting them right. Otherwise, you get two, I think, through the first five innings, and the last inning you get another one, something like that. But I've seen, you know, a lot of replays, and a lot of times things are getting turned over. But this is more balls and strikes, which you can't do an instant replay.
Yeah, you can't even argue balls and strikes
are getting called strikes that are so far outside. And with youth baseball, you tend to widen it up a little bit. But and as I always tell the kids, because as you know, we went through it, the kids would moan and groan about it's this, it's that, and I always tell the kids, "What is a strike?" It's my little thing. I say, "Kids, what is a strike?" And their answer back is supposed to be, "Whatever the umpire says is a strike."
There you go.
Because that's the truth. I mean, it changes a little bit from umpire to umpire, and you've got to adjust to whatever they're calling, and we gotta fight it off with two strikes if we don't like it, and then we have to try to take advantage of it when we're on defense. And if they're calling the outside strike, let's throw it outside and see if we can get a call to strike and frustrate their hitters all day long. And that's the only thing you can truly do about it.
Yeah.
Adjust to it and try to make it work.
And hope you don't get an ump that, I know it's only softball. We've had some
baseball.
Softball, well, for us.
Oh, for you.
Yeah. We've had some softball ups that we paid.
Paid. Oh, I'm sorry.
I'm going to get my money one way or the other. I don't want to be around here that long.
That drives me nuts.
Yeah.
In our hockey games, these guys will not call offsides, will not call ICs because they just want to get the damn game over. It's like, come on.
Yeah.
You're paid to be here.
Right.
Blow the whistle.
Yeah. It's tough when you get umps like that or refs like that.
It is. So everybody has a bad day. All right, 312-981-7200. Chuck has dialed up those numbers. Hey, Chuck, good morning.
Hey, how you doing? It's Chuck from Delvin, Wisconsin.
What's going on, Chuck?
Hey, everything's going good. I'm traveling the expressway right now. Good. And I always have the windows open, and I can hear them motorcycles coming long before, because the noise gets there, even though they're doing 140 miles an hour.
Yeah.
Whereas people with air conditioning wouldn't hear them. But I have a theory on why these children ride these motorcycles so fast, and I believe their brains are computerized to where they think that, you know, after they crash, because they played so many computer games when they were little, they just push them back up, and then they're ready to go again. And
Chuck, do you really think that they think they'll be able to push a button and regenerate into a fully functioning life form again?
Yeah, I honestly do think that that's what they think, because anybody that's got any type of sanity would know that, first of all, when you're on a motorcycle, you got to be really careful because no one else sees you. And then, to drive that fast, you don't even drive that fast in a car.
I don't drive that fast in a car. I've done 100 miles an hour before, but the way these guys go on these motorcycles, I think they're more just young and they're daredevils. And when we're young, we're kind of dumb. And we do stupid things, you know. I drove a lot faster in cars when I was young than I do now, and was, you know, much more stupid, clearly. But, yeah, it's amazing the risks people will take with their lives, especially in a motorcycle. I've just never, you know, driving fast in a car is one thing. If you crash, maybe you're going to get lucky and survive that going really fast. But on a motorcycle, I mean, what prayer do you have at 120 miles an hour? If you get an accident on a motorcycle, that helmet is, I'm guessing, not doing you a whole lot of good.
Yeah. And then you sometimes you see them, they're that crazy, and then they've got a girl strapped on the back. You know, she for dear life. And I'm like, holy smokes, those, now there's two people that are crazy.
Yeah, no kidding. No kidding. And it's funny you say you have your windows open. I didn't have my windows open because sometimes when you're going that fast on the expressway, I'm doing 80 miles an hour. I love having the windows open, but if I'm trying to listen to the radio, sometimes it's so loud. So my windows were closed, I think, at the time. But the funny thing is the one went by and it stunned me. And so I sort of like, oh, my God, as it went by in the left hand lane. And I kind of look around and then the second one went by and I'm thinking, thank God I didn't just change lanes. If somebody changes lanes, doesn't see that guy coming, how does he avoid that at that speed? That's got to be very difficult to do, I would think.
Yes, I've seen my share of accidents traveling back and forth to Chicago. But sometimes they're in packs. They might be in packs of, 10. And the thing is, the guys that are way behind, they're trying to keep up. They can't because then everybody's already hitting the brakes and they're already slowing up because of the first couple ones that went by. Now the ones that are following, they can't really go that fast because they're driving and all the drivers are like unsure. They're like looking around like, holy smokes, are there any more of these crazy children?
Yeah, no kidding. It does make you nervous, no doubt about it. Chuck, thanks so much for calling in, buddy. Have a great morning.
Thank you.
Thank you. Have a great weekend up in Delavan, Wisconsin. Raj, I don't know if you watched it all this week. There's some Scaramucci stuff that's just cracking me up. So Saturday Night Live.
Oh, I missed that.
They're doing weekend update, just the news segment, a half hour special on Thursday nights. They started one this week. They're going to do it again next week. I don't know how many more before Saturday Night Live comes back. I would think they're coming back within a couple of weeks, but they did a half hour, which was pretty funny. Kenan Thompson doing LeVar Ball. I don't know if you know who LeVar Ball is. The father of Alonzo Ball. Ball was the big draft pick coming out of college this year. He got drafted by the Lakers. LeVar Ball is a huge blowhard guy who played a little bit of college ball, but he has these three sons, the one going into the NBA, a couple more that maybe are going to be there in a few years. But LeVar just does things like talk.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I think that Michael Jost, so Kenan Thompson's portraying LeVar Ball doing a segment, and as he's throwing it back to him, I think Colin Jost says, thank you, Black Donald Trump.
Oh, wow.
Because the guy was just, you know, this is a guy who's claimed he's better than Michael Jordan.
Right.
It's a guy who averaged 2 points a game in college mm-hmm. and never played pro ball, but he says he's better than Michael Jordan.
Yeah.
And Kenan Thompson did a really funny impersonation of him, just bragging about everything. And Bill Hader, former Saturday Night Live cast member, came back to play Scaramucci.
Oh, wow.
The Scaramucci.
And I can see that.
He did a pretty good job with it. And Anthony Scaramucci himself tweeted about it.
No way.
He wrote, SNL alum Bill Hader plays Scaramucci at SNL Update. At Hader Online, he tags him and he says, more hairspray, Bill, tighter tie. So he had some fun with it.
Yeah.
But Hader, as Scaramucci said, there's a story about it and I watched it. It was so hilarious. You know how you miss me. I'm like human cocaine. You got a little bump of me. I made you feel excited, but I was out of your system too quick. And now that I'm gone, you're all depressed and edgy and you're trying to figure out how to score some more Scaramucci. And that has to be the greatest regret for Saturday Night Live. They see him come in. They're starting to think, how are we going to portray him? What's going to happen? And then, poof.
Yeah.
He's gone before he even got there.
And they were all at Saturday Night Live going, no.
It's been a bad summer for Saturday Night Live. Sean Spicer resigns.
Yeah.
Scaramucci comes and goes without them even getting to portray him.
Yeah. Oh, I think that with this administration, Saturday Night Live will have enough fodder to deal with.
I think you're probably right about that. I think now, what do you think of this? Dennis Rodman is like America's lifeline to North Korea.
Oh, yeah.
Do you think that he should get involved in this somehow? He was on Celebrity Apprentice.
He's already been involved in it twice. He went over there twice.
But that was before President Trump.
Doesn't matter. He's already done this.
He has.
Maybe he's the back channel.
Maybe he is. Maybe Trump appoints him our ambassador to North Korea. We don't have one right now, right? Because there's no diplomatic ties.
Yeah, I don't think there is.
So we make him ambassador.
Why not?
Why not?
Bring the Globetrotters.
No, I don't want to put them in harm's way.
Well, they won't be in that. They're everyone's favorite. Worldwide favorites.
I know, but that makes me nervous. I don't want to lose the Trotters.
All right.
Dennis can fend for himself, I'm guessing.
That's true.
He's been in crazier situations than that.
Oh, yeah. He beats down anyone who comes near him on the court.
Well, he kicked that photographer that one time.
That's true.
Paid a fine for that, I believe.
No, I don't think he cared.
Probably not. He was making some serious cash at the time.
Yeah.
Probably not so much anymore. And he probably blew it all. He probably could use the paycheck of being an ambassador. We're saving all the Russian money. Donald Trump thanked. That was the weirdest thing this week. They asked about Putin kicking out all the embassy and the,
right.
the staff.
He thanked them?
He said, you know what? He's saving us money. We didn't need that many people there anyways. He's cutting the payroll. So that was interesting. Yeah. All right. We're going to check in with Max or Orion in a minute. We'll have the morning show coming up next, 720 WGN.